Chapter 86. Ago and told you about in New York under seal of confidence. No other person knows of it, but Mrs. Clemens the story, to be called Hitch was a dream. A week ago I examined the MS-10000 words and saw that the plan was a totally impossible one for me, but a new plan suggested itself, and straightway the tale began to slide from the pen with ease and confidence. I think I've struck the right one this time. I have already put 12,000 words of it on paper, and Mrs. Clemens is pretty outspokenly satisfied with it, a hard critic to contend. I feel sure that all of the first half of the story and I hope 3/4 will be comedy, but by the former plan the whole of it, except the first 3 chapters, would have been tragedy and unendurable, almost. I think I can carry the reader a long way before he suspects that I am laying a tragedy trap. In the present form I could spin 16 books out of it with comfort and joy, but I shall deny myself and restrict it to 1. If you should see a little short story in a magazine in the autumn called Why Platonic Sweetheart written 3 weeks ago, that is not this one. It may have been a suggester, though. I expect all these singular privacies to interest you, and you are not to let on that they don't. We are leaving, this afternoon, for Ish, to use that as a base for the baggage, and then gather round 10 days among the lakes and mountains, to rest up Mrs. Clemens, who is jaded with housekeeping. I hope I can get a chance to work a little in spots I can't tell. But you do it, therefore, why should you think I can't? Remainder missing. The dream story was never completed. It was the same that he had worked on in London, and perhaps again in Switzerland. It would be tried at other times and in other forms, but it never seemed to accommodate itself to a central idea, so that the good writing in it eventually went to waste. The short story mentioned, My Platonic Sweetheart, a charming idyllic tale, was not published during Mark Twain's lifetime. 2 years after his death it appeared in Harper's Magazine. The assassination of the Empress of Austria at Geneva was the startling event of that summer. In a letter to Twichell, Clemens presents the tragedy in a few vivid paragraphs. Later he treated it at some length in a magazine article which, very likely because of personal relations with members of the Austrian court, he withheld from print. It has since been included in a volume of essays, What is Man, etc., to Rev. J. H. Twichell, in Hartford. Colton Lutjeban, September 13, 98. Dear Joe, you are mistaken. People don't send us the magazines. No, Harper, Century, and McClure do. An example I should like to recommend to other publishers. And so I thank you very much for sending me Brander's article. When you say, like Brander Matthews, he impresses me as a man of parts and power, I back you, right up to the hub I feel the same way. And when you say he has earned your gratitude for cuffing me for my crimes against the leather stockings and the vicar, I ain't making any objection. Earn your gratitude. His article is as sound as a nut. Brander knows literature, and loves it. He can talk about it and keep his temper. He can state his case so lucidly and so fairly and so forcibly that you have to agree with him, even when you don't agree with him. And he can discover and praise such merits as a book has, even when they are half a dozen diamonds scattered through an acre of mud. And so he has a right to be a critic. To detail just the opposite of the above invis is to describe me. I haven't any right to criticize books, and I don't do it except when I hate them. I often want to criticize Jane Austen, but her books madden me, so that I can't conceal my frenzy from the reader, and therefore I have to stop every time I begin. That good and unoffending lady, the Empress, is killed by a madman, and I am living in the midst of world history again. The Queen's Jubilee last year, the invasion of the Reichsrath by the police, and now this murder, which will still be talked of and described, and painted 1,000 years from now. to have a personal friend of the wearer of the crown burst in at the gate in the deep dusk of the evening, and say in a voice broken with tears, "My God, the Empress is murdered," and fly toward her home, before we can utter a question why, it brings the giant event home to you, makes you a part of it and personally interested. It is as if your neighbor Antony should come flying, and say Caesar is butchered, the head of the world is fallen. Of course there is no talk but of this. The mourning is universal and genuine, the consternation is stupefying. The Austrian Empire is being draped with black. Vienna will be a spectacle to see, by next Saturday, when the funeral cortege marches. We are invited to occupy a room in the sumptuous new Hotel de France, where we are to live during the fall and winter, and view it, and we shall go. Speaking of Mrs. Leader, there is a noble dame in Vienna, about whom they retail similar slanders. She said in French, she is weak in French, that as he had been spending a Sunday afternoon in a gathering of the demimonde, meaning the unknown land, that mercantile land, that mysterious half-world which underlies the aristocracy. But these malapropies are always inventions, they don't happen. Yes, I wish we could have some talks. I'm full to the eyelids. Had a noble good one with Parker and Dunham Land, but we were grateful for that visit. Yours with all our loves. Mark. Inclined with the foregoing. Among the inadequate attempts to account for the assassination, we must concede high rank to the German emperors. He justly describes it as a deed unparalleled for ruthlessness, and then adds that it was ordained from above. I think this verdict will not be popular, both. A man is either a free agent or he isn't. If a man is a free agent, this prisoner is responsible for what he has done. But if a man is not a free agent, if the deed was ordained from above, there is no rational way of making this prisoner even partially responsible for it, and the German court cannot condemn him without manifestly committing a crime. Logic is logic, and by disregarding its laws even emperors as capable and acute as William II can be beguiled into making charges which should not be ventured upon except in the shelter of plenty of lightning rods. Mark. The end of the year 1898 found Mark Twain once more in easy, even luxurious, circumstances. The hard work and good fortune which had enabled him to pay his debts had, in the course of another year, provided what was comparative affluence. His report to Howells is characteristic and interesting. To W. D. Howells, in New York. Hotel Krantz, Wien, 50. Never MARKT 6 December 30, 98. Dear Howells, I begin with a date including all the details, though I shall be interrupted presently by a South African acquaintance who is passing through, and it may be many days before I catch another leisure moment. Note how suddenly a thing can become habit, and how indestructible the habit is afterward. In your house in Cambridge 100 years ago, Mrs. Howells said to me, "Here is a bunch of your letters, and the dates are of no value, because you don't put any in the years, anyway." That remark diseased me with a habit which has cost me worlds of time and torture and ink, and millions of vain efforts and buckets of tears to break it, and here it is, yet I could easier get rid of a virtue. I hope it will interest you, for I have no one else who would much care to know it, that here lately the dread of leaving the children in difficult circumstances has died down and disappeared, and I am now having peace from that long, long nightmare, and can sleep as well as anyone. Every little while, for these 3 years now, Mrs. Clemens has come with pencil and paper and figured up the condition of things. She keeps the accounts and the bank book, and has proven to me that the clouds were lifting, and so has hoisted my spirits temporarily, and kept me going till another figuring up was necessary. Last night she figured up for her own satisfaction, not mine, and found that we own a house and furniture in Hartford, that my English and American copyrights pay an income which represents a value of $200,000, and that we have $107,000 cash in the bank. I have been out and bought a box of 6 cent cigars. I was smoking 4 1-2 centers before. At the house of an English friend, on Christmas Eve, we saw the mustache trap played and well played. I thought the house would kill itself with laughter. By George, they played with life. And it was most devastatingly funny. And it was well they did, for they put us Clemences in the front seat, and if they played it poorly I would have assaulted them. The head young man and girl were Americans, the other parts were taken by English, Irish, and Scotch girls. Then there was a nigger minstrel show, of the genuine old sort, and I enjoyed that too, for the nigger show was always a passion of mine. This one was created and managed by a Quaker doctor from Philadelphia. 23 years old, and he was the middle man. There were 9 others, 5 Americans from 5 states and a Scotchman, 2 Englishmen and an Irishman, all postgraduate medical young fellows, of course, or it could be music, but it would be bound to be one or the other. It's quite true I don't read you as much as I ought, nor anywhere near half as much as I want to. Still I read you all I get a chance to. I saved up your last story to read when the numbers should be complete, but before that time arrived some other admirer of yours carried off the papers. I will watch admirers of yours when the silver wedding journey begins, and that will not happen again. The last chance at a bound book of yours was in London nearly 2 years ago, the last volume of your Short Things, by the Harpers. I read the whole book twice through, and some of the chapters several times, and the reason that that was as far as I got with it was that I lent it to another admirer of yours, and he is admiring it yet. Your admirers have ways of their own. I don't know where they get them. Yes, our project is to go home next autumn, if we find we can afford to live in New York. We've asked a friend to inquire about flats and expenses. But perhaps nothing will come of it. We do afford to live in the finest hotel in Vienna, and have 4 bedrooms, a dining room, a drawing room, 3 bathrooms and 3 Vorzimmers, and food. But we couldn't get the half of it in New York for the same money, $600 a month. Susie hovers about us this holiday week, and the shadows fall all about us of the days when we went gypsying a long time ago. Death is so kind, so benignant, to whom he loves, but he goes by us others, and will not look our way. We saw the Astor of Palmyra last night. How death, with the gentleness and majesty, made the human grand-dashed folk around him seem little and trivial and silly. With love from all of us to all of you. Mark. Via Letters, 1899, to Howells and others. Vienna. London. A summer in Sweden, the beginning of 1899, found the Clemens family still in Vienna, occupying handsome apartments at the Hotel Krantz. Their rooms, so often thronged with gay and distinguished people, were sometimes called the Ekand Embassy. Clemens himself was the central figure of these assemblies. Of all the foreign visitors in the Austrian capital, he was the most notable. Everywhere he was surrounded by a crowd of listeners, his sayings and opinions were widely quoted. A project for world disarmament promulgated by the Tsar of Russia would naturally interest Mark Twain, and when William T. Stead, of the Review of Reviews, cabled him for an opinion on the matter, he sent at first a brief word, and on the same day, followed it with more extended comment. The great war which has since devastated the world gives to this incident an added interest. To W.M. T. Stead, in London. Number 1. Vienna, January 9. Dear Mr. Stead, - the Tsar is ready to disarm. I am ready to disarm. Collect the others, it should not be much of a task now. Mark Twain. To W.M. T. Stead, in London. Number 2. Dear Mr. Stead, peace by compulsion. That seems a better idea than the other. Peace by persuasion has a pleasant sound, but I think we should not be able to work it. We should have to tame the human race first, and history seems to show that that cannot be done. Can't we reduce the armaments little by little on a pro rata basis by concert of the powers? Can we get four great powers to agree to reduce their strength 10% a year and thrash the others into doing likewise? For, of course, we cannot expect all of the powers to be in their right minds at one time. It has been tried. We are not going to try to get all of them to go into the scheme peaceably, are we? In that case, I must withdraw my influence. Because, for business reasons, I must preserve the outward signs of sanity. Four is enough, if they can be securely harnessed together. They can compel peace, and peace without compulsion would be against nature and not operative. A sliding scale of reduction of 10% a year has a sort of plausible look, and I am willing to try that if three other powers will join. I feel sure that the armaments are now many times greater than necessary for the requirements of either peace or war. Take wartime, for instance. Suppose circumstances made it necessary for us to fight another Waterloo, and that it would do what it did before, settle a large question and bring peace. I will guess that 400,000 men were on hand at Waterloo. I have forgotten the figures. In 5 hours they disabled 50,000 men. It took them that tedious, long time because the firearms delivered only 2 or 3 shots a minute. But we would do the work now as it was done at Omdurman, with shower guns, raining 600 balls a minute. 4 men to a gun, is that the number? 150 shots a minute per man. Thus a modern soldier is 149 Waterloo soldiers in one. Thus, also, we can now retain 1 man out of each 150 in service, disband the others, and fight our Waterloos just as effectively as we did 85 years ago. We should do the same beneficent job with 2,800 men now that we did with 400,000 then. The Allies could take 1,400 of the men, and give Napoleon 1,400, and then whip him. But instead, what do we see? In wartime in Germany, Russia, and France, taken together, we find about 8 million men equipped for the field. Each man represents 149 Waterloo men, in usefulness and killing capacity. Altogether they constitute about 350 million Waterloo men, and there are not quite that many grown males of the human race now on this planet. Thus we have this insane fact that whereas those three countries could arm 18,000 men with modern weapons, and make them the equals of 3 million men of Napoleon's day, and accomplish with them all necessary war work, they waste their money and their prosperity creating forces of their populations in piling together 349,982,000 extra Waterloo equivalents which they would have no sort of use for, if they would only stop drinking, and sit down and siffer a little. Perpetual peace we cannot have on any terms, I suppose, but I hope we can gradually reduce the war strength of Europe till we get it down to where it ought to be 20,000 men, properly armed. Then we can have all the peace that is worthwhile, and when we want a war anybody can afford it. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.